This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. From time to time, we check back in with noted Indiana economist, speaker, and writer Morton Marcus about some of his Eye on the Pie columns that are published around the state of Indiana. And Morton's with us from his office in Indianapolis to talk about them. Hi, Morton. How are you today?
Just fine, Chris. Thank you.
Let's start in here with one of the latest ones that have come out, talking about exports, imports, and Indiana's economy.
We have a major activity in exporting the goods that we produce. These are manufactured goods that we're talking about only. There's much more that goes into foreign trade, but the column that I wrote deals only with the manufactured side. Mm-hmm. And Indiana basically has a good balance of trade with Canada because of all the auto parts that we ship to Canada. And we have a very positive situation with Mexico as well. We ship a lot of medications out of the state of Indiana from our pharmaceutical companies. And strangely enough, we've got a negative relationship. That is, we import more than we export from Ireland. And I think a lot of that is within individual companies, mm-hmm. where they have facilities in Ireland, and they then ship them back to the home base here in Indiana.
Well, I know that Governor Eric Holcomb is going to be making another trade trip. This time he is going to Canada. In fact, I understand that Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson is going to join the delegation on that trip, which is coming up this next week. So I'm sure that the governor must feel that having her there will certainly give her a little education, plus maybe she can make a pitch or two for Northwest Indiana while she's there.
Oh, I think that will be quite in order, and I think it could be quite successful. Mm-hmm. We do have that excellent position within the United States, and so easy to come across I-94 from Canada, and on the way to the great transportation center that we have in metropolitan Chicago.
Mm-hmm. One of the other columns you did too, I know some of it was a lot of it was really tongue in cheek, but it did talk about some interesting things. You were talking about the correlation between prisons and colleges and how they, in a way, seem to be related in that they are really a good economic magnet. Tell us about that, please.
Well, you think about Michigan City, and one of its major industries, of course, is the prison there.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just the number of prisoners, but it's the number of workers and other firms that tend to provide services to the prison. We find the same thing with the universities. Our state universities and our private universities draw students from all over the world, and then there's a lot of services that have to be provided to them. And these are forms of export, in a way, exports for the individual communities or for the state, in that we're selling services to other places.
We sell
a lot of pizza to those students.
Yes, that's true. And I think people kind of forget that at times, unless you happen to live in a community like Michigan City and it's there, so you know, you see the truck traffic go by and see the impact that the prison, as sprawling as it may be, and certainly not much activity because everything is indoors inside,
mm-hmm.
May be happening, but it does have a big impact on the local economy, to be sure. So
that's right, and we tend to forget that, and we think about trying to attract other industries. There's a long-standing joke that says that when the state was considering establishing its various universities, that at the same time they were thinking of developing mental institutions, mm-hmm. and Logansport picked the mental institution, Bloomington picked the university, and people in Logansport have been very happy ever since.
One of the other columns that you had in, Morton, was talking about an issue which I know did not get very far in the legislative session that just ended here, was talking about townships and consolidation and trying to bring townships together of smaller sizes and to create larger ones. Will you go back through that column and explain what you felt in your way of putting it, brought out the problem about how many townships we have in Indiana?
Well, we have a lot of townships. I think the number is about 1,005 now. It used to be 1,008. But the question is, do we need all these township governments? Some people think about it in terms of saving money. I don't think of it in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
I think the real question is, could we provide better services for people? And none of the discussion that I've seen really focuses on that aspect of it. What is it we expect the township government to do? In some townships, it's the volunteer fire department. In almost every township, there's a certain amount of poor relief that goes on, emergency funding for people who need $100 to pay an electric bill and things of that sort. But we really ought to ask ourselves, what is it that we want the township government to do? It used to be, when we started our state system, that the township provided education. There was the township school. The township was responsible for the roads in the area. And today those functions have been taken over by school districts and taken over by county or state highway departments. We ought to ask ourselves, what is it that we are currently doing with townships, and can it be done better if it's taken over by a larger unit? Or are there other things that should be done that nobody's doing and that could be done best if you were serving small numbers of people?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not against something just because it's large or just because it's small. I think what we ought to say is, what's the best way of providing services to people?
I know you bring up in that column a topic that has it's been a long time, I guess, it's been mentioned, but it seems to be coming back, and that's referring to the Kernan Shepherd report, which came out more than a decade ago.
That's
which
right.
is an interesting document in itself. For folks that are not familiar with that, maybe have forgotten about that, refresh our memories and kind of put that in the context of what you mentioned in the column.
Well, the Kernan Shepherd report basically gave us a sort of a blueprint for making improvements in government at all levels. And they were very concerned about the fact that we have so many different governmental units, so many cities and towns, as we see in Lake County and in Porter County as well. Does it really make sense to have all of these governmental units? And again, it's not a question of saving money. That's how people think about it. But the real issue is, are we going to find that the smaller units of government are much more responsive to the needs of the people? It doesn't mean that the people in Schererville really have much of a difference in their idea of public services from the people in Dyer or the people in St. John or the people in Highland. The issue has to be, how do we provide these services in the best possible fashion? Fire safety is an obvious one, but there are existing relationships now between most of the fire departments, and so if they need a few extra trucks in one community, they easily get them from another community. They help out. They have these working partnerships. Again, it's not a question of money alone, and yet that's how so many people look at it. The thing that troubled me about the Kernan Shepherd report is that it's basically without any supporting evidence.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it is on the basis of, well, we think it would be better if. And I just don't think that we ought to go ahead on that basis alone.
So doesn't
it's sort of like my feelings about this Lake South Shore extension down to Dyer.
Yeah,
I've always felt that there isn't really enough empirical evidence been presented and that it's being built on the basis that, you know, if you build it, they will come. I don't know who they are. Yeah.
So I guess in a way you think that maybe in some of the aspects in the Kern and Shepherd report might be, we'd be wishful thinking, I suppose.
I believe that it's sort of the general belief that mm-hmm. we would have economies as a result of combining the various units. We have seen situations where units of government have been combined. Indianapolis is one of the great examples of that. But no one's ever been able to write a report showing me that, that somehow the people in Indianapolis either got better services or that they saved some money. Now, I have seen it with some libraries mm-hmm. where the quality of service goes up when you're dealing with a larger library system, and the expenses can actually go down. But that has been demonstrated. But I haven't seen it with many of the other things. It's the same way with schools. You know, we're going to consolidate the schools, and we have consolidated a lot of schools, but we don't go in and do any studies afterwards to see whether it actually fulfills the promise.
We're talking with a noted Indiana economist and writer and speaker, Morton Marcus, about his columns.
Troublemaker, that's the
troublemaker.
Word.
There we go. That's probably true, too. Gadfly might be another term, too, I suppose.
Yes.
That's talking about his Eye on the Pie columns that come out on a regular basis around Indiana. One of the other columns I know, Morton, that was very interesting and certainly very local, talks about potholes and how that might be a good project for the researchers at Purdue University to take up. Tell us about that.
Well, we do have a research unit at Purdue.
Yeah.
That is concerned with road surfaces, and they do a lot of work and have been doing a lot of work for 20 years, but they don't seem to be making a lot of progress. And it isn't just here in Indiana. It's also true all across the same latitude. You know, it's true in Ohio, and it's true in Illinois and Missouri and Kansas, you know, just straight across I-70, basically. And I-80 is the same way. We have a lot of potholes, in large part because we, particularly in Indiana, don't put the money into building the roads properly in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
We may not make the concrete thick enough. We may not put in sufficient amount of asphalt. But there are things that could be done at relatively low cost. I'll tell you my simplest solution that
okay.
would be very helpful. When I'm driving at night, and particularly if it's raining, it's very hard to see a pothole. And what I would like to see is I'd like to see the city or the state or somebody go around, maybe this is a role for township government, and paint the potholes with the kind of paint that reflects my headlights back.
Ah. Not a bad idea. You could probably find a paint that would be economical enough in cost because you'll have to use huge quantities of it sometimes to mark all those potholes, I would imagine. Say the least. Well, Morton, we appreciate you spending time with us today and that we will be checking back in with you again really soon to find out more of the Eye on the Pie columns and your viewpoints. We've been talking with noted Indiana economist, writer, and speaker Morton Marcus and getting an idea on the Eye on the Pie, as he puts it. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Music's always been a major part of my life. My parents, there was a theater in Chicago called the Regal Theater. And when I was growing up, as early as 2 years old, I can remember going over to the Regal and seeing people like Duke Ellington and Count Basie and Sarah Vaughan, all the top jazz people as I grew up. We lived upstairs on the second floor of my godmother's house. The piano actually was given to me by another godmother that I had. So we got the piano, and my mother said, well, you'll be taking piano lessons. Okay, you know. But the piano was on the front porch where I could look out and see everybody running up and down the street playing. So the deal was that I was going to practice every day for an hour, no matter what. And this friend would come over, and he'd be sitting there because he wanted to go out and play. And I can remember him saying, "Can you hurry up?" You know what I'm saying? There's no way to hurry up an hour. It is what it is. I tell people now, you know, I've never seen anybody make a dime playing hide and seek. Eventually, I grew to love it. You know, I'd be at the piano for 4 hours and not one. I really didn't actually learn how to play jazz until actually I got out of college and started rubbing elbows with other people who actually played the music. And I learned from them and kind of on the job training, really. I had a trio, then I had a quartet, and then I formed a band that had five pieces. And at that time, there were about 30 different clubs in Gary where you could go from one spot and play, and the next weekend you could play someplace else. And we would actually, on our breaks, run from one club to the other to listen to another guy play and then come back and play some more. So that's really how this all got started. The thing is about jazz is that we have access to it. There's some things that some minorities don't even have access to. The symphony was something that we didn't have equal access to. You know, so you couldn't prove your mettle there. But jazz, you always could. It's one of the, I guess, racial forerunners in it, because there have been mixed bands since when? Whether you're white or black, once you hit the bandstand, then you're on your own. If you can play, you can play. If you can't, you know, you can't. And it's obvious to everybody. And I guess it's the same way in sports. It's an equalizer. Once here at the university, we played with a guy named Red Rodney. He was a white guy that played with Charlie Parker. He was telling us the story of when they went down south, he had red hair, kind of a light complexion. So they billed him as Albino Red, you know, because the mixed bands couldn't travel the south. When Duke Ellington went south, he rented a set of Pullman cars, and the guys would just travel the south. They wouldn't do hotels. Blacks couldn't stay in the regular hotels, so they worked off of the Pullman cars. Well, there's a jazz musician named Clark Terry, and he had played in this band that used to go down to Carroll, Illinois. My mother used to see that band. And he played in Duke Ellington's band for about 9 years. And so I was riding in the car with him, and I was saying, "I know you used to play in Eddie Randall's band, and you guys used to go down to Carroll and play." And he said, "Oh, yeah, that's that city where the guy came up on the bandstand and cut Duke Ellington's tie in half." Those are the kinds of things that used to, you know, can you imagine a man of Duke Ellington's stature having something like that happen? My take on the whole thing is that all of the races on the planet were put here by God. All of us have different takes on things. If everybody would work together, you know, my strength might help you and your strength might help. It's like a puzzle. All the pieces of the puzzle can't be the same. You know, they have to be different. The differences are really a strength. I don't see why you would want to be by everybody that's just like you. If everybody were like me, it might be kind of sad, you know. I need somebody that plays the saxophone. I don't need a bunch of piano players.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Homesnacks.net, which is a national infotainment website, as it bills itself, just came out with a list of the safest places to live in Indiana, and Lake County ranks pretty high on the 2018 list. Nick Johnson of Homesnacks.net was with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about the website and where the Lake County communities had ranked on the list this year.
Homesnacks are bite-sized information about where you live. So what we do is we take data that we scrape off of the internet, and we look at what it's like to live in places from a number of unique perspectives. So a lot of people want to decide if they want to move somewhere, and you can go and you can look at, you know, different metrics out there that are pretty common. But what we like to do is kind of pull up the cover a little bit and look at data from a different perspective. Mm-hmm.
And speaking of data, how did you and your team there help come up with this list of the 10 safest cities in Indiana for 2018?
Well, for this particular story and data set, we didn't look at a very unique perspective. A lot of publications will put out the most dangerous places and the most safest. All we did was we looked at the FBI statistics for property and violent crime per capita. So number of thefts and also the number of people that are, you know, getting attacked and raped and all the other major horrible crimes that happen, and just divided it by the size of the city.
Let's go down the list now here. Starting out, we'll start at the bottom. Number 10 is Lowell, which is, of course, in South Lake County. Tell us about Lowell and why you folks thought it was a very interesting place to put down on the list of one of the safest cities in Indiana.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about Lowell is it was the 10th safest last year. It's been no real change. But, you know, the property crime, so there's not a lot of property crime in Lowell. It's actually the third least number of thefts per capita in the state of Indiana. Mm-hmm. So it's a safe place to be.
Was there anything else that you all found in looking through the data that was interesting about Lowell to put on the list as well?
Not in particular. I mean, you know, it's relatively safe when you look across the board per capita. But what is interesting about Lake County, you know, I used to live in Indiana. I spent a lot of time in Lafayette, and I used to travel that corridor.
Right.
A lot of people are surprised a little bit, I think, when you mention Lake County, especially because of the location to, you know, the Michigan-Illinois little triangle up there. People have a certain way that they think that things exist up in that part of the state. But actually, you know, there's, like you said, there's four places that rank high statistically for being safe up there. So that's pretty interesting.
Well, I'm surprised about the fact that Lowell is on the list here. A lot of folks, even in Lake County, in the northern part of the county, have been finding places to build homes or have homes built in South Lake County, and a lot of people have been moving down close to Lowell, so it's not surprising that they should be on that list of safest places to live in Indiana. Number six on the list is Lake County's county seat, Crown Point. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, so Crown Point actually didn't really rank last year on our list. And part of that might be the fact that occasionally cities don't turn in FBI data or report their crime data. So the fact that they're up there isn't really that surprising. But we didn't have numbers for them last year, so we didn't really know how to kind of put this into perspective. But it's the eighth safest for violent crime, which means, you know, rapes and murders and horrible attacks. So it's very safe when it comes to, you know, number of violent crimes, and it's the 13th safest when it comes to property crimes.
Wow.
So it's a great place to be. You know, it could be a little chilly up there, but besides that, it's a safe place.
We're used to that up here, or we should be, to be sure. Number five, right behind Crown Point on the list, is the community of Dyer, which is not far to the north and a little bit to the west of Crown Point. Tell us about Dyer.
Yeah, Dyer was actually the safest place, or one of the safest places. It was third. It dropped a couple of spots. But, you know, I mean, super low crime rates. I mean, you have a 1 in 2,000, almost 3,000 chance of being the victim of a violent crime. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you live in Dyer, you're gonna have a, you know, your neighbors are probably going to be typically people that you know and you hang out with. And if you do commit a crime in Dyer, it's typically either you know who done it or it's somebody from out of town in a place like that. So.
And finally, at the top of the list, just a few spaces up the list here, at number one is St. John, Indiana. And that, again, is now, I guess, ranked as the safest community to live in Indiana. How did St. John get to the top of the list?
Yeah, St. John is actually, you know, last year was also the safest, so it continues to be an awesome place. And, you know, it's the second safest for property crime. So, I mean, you have a 1 in 135 chance of being a victim of a property crime. It means if you live in a little neighborhood, there's probably a chance that nobody's even had a property crime last year, which even, you know, that's car break-ins and home break-ins. And that's pretty astounding that you'll have, you know, not very, very high of a chance to be a victim of a property crime. And, you know, it's the fifth safest for violent crimes as well. So if you add it all up, I mean, if you were to compare it to, we like to sort of, to put things into perspective, compare some of these communities to some of the more dangerous places in the country. So a town like Little Rock, Arkansas, you have a 1 in 30 chance of being the victim of a property crime. So
right.
There's a chance that on every street in Little Rock, somebody's the victim of some sort of a crime. and you have a, you know, almost a 10 times higher chance of not being the victim in a place like St. John. So congrats to the folks up there in Lake County. It sounds like it's a great place.
That's Nick Johnson from Homesnacks.net. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Valparaiso University's Institute for Leadership and Service is continuing to offer its very special speaker series called Pathways to Purpose. And to talk about it, we have the executive director of the Institute with us, Elizabeth Lynn. Elizabeth, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
No, nice to talk to you, Chris. Each semester, we bring in five or six really remarkable practitioners of leadership and service. We bring them to Valparaiso University. They spend a day on campus getting to know our students, faculty, and staff. We welcome community members as well to come to their public talks in the evening. And the goal of the program overall is to expand imagination about how we can lead and serve in the world, and particularly to show students how they can connect what they studied when they were at Valpo with those very creative pathways that leaders take to put their studies to work in service to the world. All of our speakers, the public presentations, are on Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. So all the dates I'll be giving will be Wednesdays. You can also go to our website, Institute for Leadership and Service at Valparaiso University. Just Google that. We'll come up and look up our schedule there. But she's speaking at 5:30 p.m. in the Helge Center, which is attached to the Chapel of the Resurrection, which is at the center of our campus. Mm-hmm. And
we're talking with Elizabeth Lynn, who is the executive director of Valparaiso University's Institute for Leadership and Service. And we're talking in particular about the Spring 2018 Pathways to Purpose speaker series. The series takes a break in March and comes back in April, April 25th to be exact here. And kind of jumping over to the distaff side, we have a gentleman who's coming to campus to talk about investing in innovation. Tell us what Stephen Lehman's going to have to talk about.
Yeah. So Stephen Lehman's coming from a short distance, just the University of Chicago in Hyde Park in Chicago. He's a graduate of Valparaiso University. He did his bachelor's in mechanical engineering. Again, it's interesting to think, how does one get from mechanical engineering to investing in innovation at the University of Chicago? He holds an MBA from Notre Dame as well, and he studied the humanities. He is the assistant director of the University of Chicago Innovation Fund, which is an early-stage fund dedicated to the commercialization of research and technology generated at the university. So they invest in promising startups from an ecosystem that includes not only the University of Chicago, but Argonne National Laboratory, Fermilab, and the Marine Biological Laboratory. Their core mission is to help researchers turn their innovations into ventures that advance cutting-edge technologies, generate significant financial returns, and create lasting impact for humankind. Now, again, it's interesting to think about how this kind of support of startups and technology can also be joined to our deepest values about what is of importance, what is good for humankind, and he's clearly thinking about that. And we'll be talking about that on April 25th, again at 5:30 p.m., and again in the Helge Center at Valparaiso University.
Now, this last in the series, the Pathways to Purpose series, is coming up on May 2nd. In fact, somebody I've heard of, and you may have heard her too, certainly NPR's Code Switch team oftentimes contributes features and stories to Morning Edition and All Things Considered and some of the other news magazines on NPR that you get to hear on Lakeshore Public Radio. But we get to have one of the founding members of Code Switch joining us here for this very special conversation. Tell us what Kat Chow is saying she's going to talk about.
Well, she's going to talk about telling complicated stories. And she really will help focus our attention on how we tell the complicated stories of race, ethnicity, and culture in our own society. She's just a remarkable person. She appears on NPR in a variety of contexts. Mm-hmm. So you might have heard her. She's an occasional chair on NPR's podcast, Pop Culture Happy Hour. She's worked with the show Invisibilia. And so she's also been involved with local lore. So those are all for NPR nerds. Those are all names to catch.
We picked her up on some of the Invisibilia pieces before on our programs too. Yeah.
Excellent. Wonderful program. And she is a founding member of Code Switch. Now, that's an award-winning team that covers these complicated stories that really weave through our experience every day here in Northwest Indiana and elsewhere. Stories of race, ethnicity, and culture. Mm-hmm. She makes new episodes for the Code Switch podcast, so you can check that out if you want to listen to the podcast. Reports online for Code Switch, and also does on-air pieces for shows like Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
Right. We should make a note, too, that Kat's presentation on May 2nd is not going to be at the Helge Center, as usual, but it is going to be in a very special place because we're expecting a big crowd to hear her. That's going to happen at the Duesenberg Recital Hall, isn't it?
Yes, that's in the Valparaiso University Center for the Arts, and is a lovely, lovely, small, but slightly larger than our own space here at the Helge Center Recital Hall. So you would want to get here early to get a seat, but you will really be in a very intimate and comfortable recital hall, getting to hear it from this phenomenal creative person in the world of radio, and also thinking about race, culture, gender, and identity. Yeah. May 2nd, and it's also, I just want to mention, it's at 5 p.m., not 5:30 that night.
Okay, and that's going to be a great way to close out the Pathways to Purpose series for the spring of 2018. And once again, Elizabeth, if anybody has any questions, they'd like to get the list of the speakers, we kind of run down them here briefly, where folks find that list.
Yeah, just go to the Valparaiso University website and search for Institute for Leadership and Service, or just Google Pathways to Purpose at valpo.edu, and it'll pop right up. And so all the details are there. You can also follow us on Facebook, Institute for Leadership and Service at Valparaiso University. We have a very savvy social media team, and they keep it very well populated with information about our programs. We have not just Pathways to Purpose, but other public events we support from time to time throughout the year. And if you haven't been to the campus of Valparaiso University recently or at all, this is a great way to get to know us as a real treasure in the region, in the country, and in the world. So I hope your listeners will come and join us on their own Pathways to Purpose.
Well, I certainly hope so, too. Elizabeth Lynn, thank you very much for telling us about this particular interesting series as it continues on for the spring of 2018 and all the great speakers coming to Valparaiso University this spring. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Chris. Take care.
There will be a special legislative session later this year. The governor made the official announcement on Monday, and as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay tells us, lawmakers will likely take up some unfinished education issues when they reconvene.
Bills around school finances and security failed in the final hours of this year's legislative session. Debate on the school finances bill focused mostly on the management of Muncie and Gary schools, but Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick says there were other key elements in that bill that lawmakers should consider.
There were the fiscal indicators that were also in that bill that would have allowed us to be more proactive versus reactive.
She says those would help the state track schools' finances and help avoid more state takeovers. McCormick also says another vital part of the bill is to offer Muncie schools a multi-million-dollar loan. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.